All right, cool. All right, so who remembers where we left off last week in our Bible class? Anybody?
We want to start with page 40.
Okay, all right, we're starting. Yeah?
Yeah, there you start.
Yes. We're in the middle of lesson 10. We're starting the section on page 40. You'll find the text list for that.
Bottom of page 39,
by the way. Does anyone? Okay. I don't. So I had extras, and they walked away. And I didn't give them out. They just walked away. Okay. Thanks, Lala. What's that? Yeah, I will. I need to, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're at sort of at the bottom of page 39, beginning top of page 40, right? The first thing that happens, well, in this, well, as far as this narrative is concerned, we've got Jesus healing two people who have been possessed by demons. One of the interesting thing is Matthew says there are two people. Luke and Mark only focus on one of the two people. They only talk about one individual. Hugs after class, Mom. Come on. I'm playing those, you guys, so you know I'm joking. So here we are. Our texts in question are Matthew chapter 8, verses 28 through 34, Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 21, and Luke chapter 8, verses 26 through 40, right? So those are the texts in question. One of the things we did point out, of course, is Matthew actually talks about two people, but even though there are two men, even Matthew's narrative focuses on one of the men, right? And Luke and Mark just talk about that one guy. And when Jesus, so this sort of, this area happens in Gerasene or Gennesaret. It's sort of flexible. Which name you use depends on sort of which translation, and that depends on which manuscript they're using. So, you know, here we are in this section, right? And this, by the way, is the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, right? So, who lives on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee? You guys know? Well, who lives on the western side? Well, that's where Capernaum is, right? So you got Peter, you got Andrew, you got James, you got John. And what do they all have in common aside from being fishermen? Right? What else do they all have in common? They were called by, okay, and aside from that, aside from being of the 12, what do they all have in common? Think more basic. No, not even more basic than that. What was their ethnic background and religious persuasion? Come on, guys. They were Jews. All right, so the Jews lived on the western side of the Sea of Galilee. Who lived on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee?
Gentiles.
There we go. So this is Gentile territory, right? Now, there are some Jews who live on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, but there are not that many. They are by far in the minority, right? So this is actually Gentile territory that Jesus is in right now. Although, you'll find that more Jews lived on the northern side of the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee than lived on the southern side. So, especially when we're dealing with northern Galilee, you got a higher concentration of Jews there. And that's where Jesus is right now. So, when Jesus arrives on the other side of the sea, who meets him? A man who has a demon, right? A man who's possessed by an unclean spirit. What does this guy look like? Okay. All right, he ain't got no clothes on. All right. He did not live in a house. I mean, they had built a house for him, but he didn't stay there. Right? Where did he stay? Out in the tombs. Now, where did they bury people back in these days? Caves in the hills, right? That's where they buried people. They buried people in caves in the hillsides. So he's living out in the caves that are serving as tombs, as crypts, as mausoleums. And caves are often communal burying grounds. Groups of people would be put in the same cave, right? And so he's living out among the carcasses, right? The bones, the rotting flesh. He has no clothes on. What else? What else is there about his appearance, right? That's sort of special. That's different. I won't say special. I'll say different. What else do the text say about his appearance?
He's bruised all over.
And cut too, right? He's got sores and bruises all over his body. Why?
Because he
hits himself against the rocks. He slams himself against the rocks, right? Over and over and over. And that takes a toll. That does damage to your body, right? So he's covered in bruises. He's got cuts. He's got scrapes. He's bleeding.
Why did he do that?
He was possessed by a demon, right? That's part of what happens. That's part of what happened with him, right? The way these things manifest is different with, you know, sort of each case that the New Testament deals with, that Jesus and the apostles each deal with, right? But that was what this guy, that's how it's manifesting with this guy. When Jesus comes, this guy sort of comes out from the tombs to meet him, along with the other guy who's there, who's sort of there for a little bit in Matthew's narrative and then just kind of drops out of it, right? Because the second guy is possessed by a demon, but apparently his case is sort of not as bad as this guy that the narrative really focuses on. So this guy comes out to meet Jesus, right? So what does he say to Jesus? Well, sorry, I went through that a little fast. So what does he say to Jesus? What are you going to do to me, right? Don't torment me. What you going to do? Don't torment me, right? Yeah?
I'd like to point out that's what the demon says.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what comes out of the guy's mouth.
The demon is the one
doing the talking.
Also doing the damage to him.
Right. Right. Yes, so here's one of the things that we should probably address, right? And this is sort of a good time to do it because we actually have more about this guy and how this affects him than we do other people in Scripture, right? So I have never dealt with a situation personally where someone says something like this, but I've got friends who've been preaching who have had people that they're talking to, you know, come to them and say, you know, I've got this sin in my life that I can't seem to get rid of. And I think a demon is making me do it, right? Or I think the devil is making me do it. First of all, do you guys buy that? No, right? Because mom's raising an interesting point, right? It seems like you lose physical control over yourself, right? But here's something else that happens with all of the accounts of possession that we see in Scripture, right? That happened during the days of the miracles, right? Do any of the accounts in Scripture have demons or unclean spirits causing these men to commit sin? Anybody want to say yes? Nobody wants to say yes, huh? Anybody want to say no? No, nobody wants to say no, huh? Nobody wants to go out on a limb and take a stance here? Oh, come on, guys. I'll tell you this. All the ones that I've read that I remember reading about, sin is not a part of the picture. Well, I mean, Yeah, that's unusual. The pigs are sort of an interesting case, right? Well, we can talk about that, you know, when we get to that point in the narrative, right? But as far as, you know, when we deal with demons and humans, right? we don't have any actual textual this is what happens, right? But we put the pieces together of all the accounts where this happens. The conclusions that we're sort of forced to come to is that, you know, sin has to be our choice, right? And so when these guys get hijacked like this, the demons don't cause them to sin, right? So when I've had these preachers who are friends of mine have these conversations, I think a demon is possessing me that's causing me to do this sin. It's like, hold on, that's not how it works. Okay, but, you know, sin is always my choice, right? My choice to rebel against God's law, right? That's what it boils down to. Bob?
Alcohol is sometimes referred to as spirits. Is that, why is that? Is that valid?
Okay, that's just a linguistic convention, and it's not valid because when we're talking about spirits in the sense of Scripture, we're talking about something that is conscious, that has an active will, that is an actual conscious entity, right? That's not booze. Alcohol is... Okay, so one thing I will say, well, it's probably best if we have this conversation outside of class, because if we wade into it, it's going to take a little bit too long.
Right? Alcohol is a huge sin.
We should have this conversation outside of class. I'm just going to leave it at that. Because if we get into it now, it's going to take a while.
I understand.
So, Jesus here, dealing with this man, right? This question, this whole issue of, you know, this guy is doing these things, right? But he's not in control of himself at the same time. But again, when you put all the pictures of possession together, they never cause a person to sin, right? At least there's never any account of that actually happening in Scripture. So, it's sort of hard to say that when Scripture doesn't support that, right? And so I just sort of wanted to, since Mom brought up the whole issue of this guy's losing control of himself, we also need to understand that it seems as though there are rules, right? God had rules with Satan and Job, right? That God is the one who sort of set the boundaries around Satan. Like, you can do this, but you can't do this, right? And so there are rules, right? And we can sort of make some educated guesses about what those rules are based on Scripture. And those seem to be part of the rules because every single narrative in Scripture supports that, right? Mom, had your hand up. Yes, and that's another thing, is that the knowledge that is possessed by, you know, the demons at the time who are speaking through these men is beyond what the people around them have, right? They see truths that other people don't acknowledge, other people are not even aware of, right? And they acknowledge them to be true, which is something that James actually says, right? In James chapter 2, when he's talking about faith and works, right? He says, even the demons actually have a kind of faith, but that doesn't save them, right? And they're terrified of God's power, right? But that doesn't help them, right? They're not acting in accordance with God's will. They're acting contrary to it. And so, I mean, it's not just enough to have faith, right? It's got to motivate you to do the right thing. And that's a part of James's discussion about faith, right? James chapter 2, when, you know, that statement, faith without works is dead. Well, that's a whole part of the build-up to that. Actually the follow after that statement, right? So, and that's another part that Mom's bringing out. These demons know who Jesus is. They know what Jesus is. And that comes out in not just here, but in every discussion that Jesus has with people who have a case of possession going on in Scripture. So what does Jesus do after this guy says, you know, what are you going to do to me? Don't torment me. What's your name? And he asks him what his name is, right? So when he asks this question, right, what's the answer? Why? Well, my name is Legion, right? Why? This guy had a lot of problems, right? It wasn't just one with this guy, right? This guy was a little motel. And I sort of, you know, I don't mean to make light of his situation by making a somewhat comedic metaphor, but, you know, this guy had some serious, serious issues, right? He had a lot of things going on. One of the things, so now we're going to get to Matthew recording a second man who had a demon driven out by Jesus here. Why don't Mark or Luke? I think it's a fair question. Think about it just for a minute. Who wrote Matthew?
Tax collector.
Matthew, right? What was Matthew aside from being a tax collector? What was he? How is he different from Mark and Luke? Oh, come on, guys. What position did Matthew have within the church?
Well, his other name is Levi.
Levi, okay. That just means his name's Levi.
Can you be from another tribe and be named Levi?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, you have priests named Judah. They're not from the tribe of Judah, but there's a lot of priests throughout Jewish history that have been named Judah before. What was he within the organizational structure of the New Testament church? Come on, guys. Peter, Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, Matthew, James the Zealot. Thank you. Finally, we got it. He's one of the 12, right? Okay, which means what about Matthew and this narrative? When they're replacing Judas, right, in Acts chapter 1, the way they whittle down the candidates to Matthias and the other guy, what were their requirements?
Eyewitness.
He had to be with Jesus from the time of the baptism all the way to the time of the ascension. Right? That means Matthew was there. Okay? Now, Mark predominantly is the memoirs of Peter, but Mark still wasn't there. Right? So when people are telling the story, right? And by the way, the fact that Mark and Luke only talk about one guy, does that mean that there's not a second guy there? Does that mean these events are contradictory? No, it just means that Matthew is supplying a little bit more information than the other guys. Right? That's all this means. Okay? But Matthew was actually there. He's drawing from his own firsthand personal memories. Mark and Luke are both drawing from the testimony of other people, which doesn't make it wrong. All it means is the people they spoke to remember the one guy so profoundly that he's the only person that sticks out in their mind. Okay? And I wanted to address this because, you know, some people say, Matthew says there's two. These are only the other ones say there's one. No, they say there's one. They don't say there's only one. Okay? There's a difference. And the reason they say there's one is because that's the guy that's memorable, right? But Matthew was there himself, and he remembers both. He says there were two, but this guy had a lot more going on, right? And so it's important for us to understand why things are in the way they are by the different writers that write about them. And so I wanted to go through that, right? So Matthew was actually there. That's why he has more detail here, because he's drawing again on his personal firsthand memories of the situation. And it's also interesting that Mark does that with things that involve Peter. That a lot of the scenes that have Peter as an integral part, Mark is more detailed. Because Mark is listening to Peter's memories. Right? And so Peter's remembering all the things that happened to him. And Mark's just taking it all down. Right? And so that helps us understand why Mark is so Peter-centric in certain sections of the book, right? What does Jesus do with the demons that have been possessing their victims? He says, you guys need to get out right now. You guys need to get out, right? And they say, well, don't send us back. And Jesus is like, well, not immediately, I guess. Right? And so they ask to be allowed. First of all, they ask to be allowed, by the way. They ask for his permission to enter into the swine, which tells us that, you know, they've got to get his permission, right? And he says, okay, fine. So how do the pigs react to the demons' presence? They go crazy, they stampede, and they run over a cliff, right? And so what happens to the demons now? Well, we don't know, but we presume they got to go back where they came from, right? Because, you know, the pigs are dead, they got to leave the pigs now. Jesus isn't letting them go anywhere else. So they ask not to be allowed to go back, and Jesus says, okay, not for now, but we'll see in about 5 minutes. So that's sort of, so we covered that, right? So what happens to the man who's possessed by this legion? Okay, first of all, right? Bro gets a bath. Bro gets his wounds washed and cleaned. Bro needs some clothes. Right? And all that happens. And as Jesse said, he sits at Jesus' feet and starts talking and listening and just basking in the presence of Christ. And I want you guys to think about this for a minute, right? Imagine that you're one of the people who lives in this village, right? First of all, are you ever going to go out to the tombs? Not unless you got to bury someone, right? And even then, you're going to try and find out where that guy is that day and bury him somewhere else. I mean, imagine being there, like, when this first starts happening to these poor guys, to one guy in particular, right? Does anybody like being woken up at 2 in the morning? No. Oh, Demetrius is all saying, I'm still up. Like, yeah, wait till you hit 30, bro. Ain't going to happen for long. So, the other thing is, I mean, when I was living in the Philippines, right? The Philippines, you know, being a country that's 78% Catholic, there's chapels like on every, like, every barangay has at least every little section of every town and every tiny little village out in the country has a Catholic chapel, right? And some barangays even have like 4 or 5, especially when you get into Manila, like a little tiny place will have like 5 or 6 in one tiny little neighborhood. It's outrageous. Like, they're all over the place, right? And all our Filipino brothers and sisters in the audience can vouch for that. So when I first moved to Gigera, we were living in a part of town called San Gabriel, right? And the local chapel was like right around the corner from us. Like, actually just right around the corner. So Filipinos, like Latino Catholics sometimes, right? In the weeks leading up to Christmas, you know what starts to happen? They start to have early morning mass. And they do it every day. Okay? Something is messing with our ladder back there. We'll have to look at... Maybe that's where the skunk is.
Demons.
that emit an odor that smells a lot like a skunk that we had last week going on. So... Marcus, I think, is on his way to check it out right now. We'll see. Be careful, bro. Might be a skunk. So, you know when they start the early morning mass? 4 in the morning, right? Okay. And you know what they do for like 15 minutes before the early morning mass starts? They ring those bells, man. They ring those bells. So like for 2 weeks before Christmas, you know what happens to me every morning at 3:45? But the thing is, like by the end of like the first week, I got used to it, right? Because my body began to adjust to the fact that it kind of subconsciously started to know that this was going to happen every morning. And I imagine that something like that happened to these villagers, right? Because, I mean, the noises, the screaming, the wailing, the shouting that this guy was doing, right? At first, it's jarring. But then they get used to it. And sort of, how weird is it that you get used to having that around, by the way? Like, is that in any way, shape, or form normal behavior? Like, no, at all. Not by any stretch. It's not normal behavior at all. But they got, I imagine they got used to it. Because, you know, you get used to the things around you. And so now they're used to that. He's now a town fixture, right? He's sort of just the thing that they've got going on. It's what keeps them weird, like Portland. Now imagine yourself being used to that every day. You're just like, when it happens, you don't even notice it anymore, right? But imagine seeing that guy now, clean, clothed, and rational, with his beard trimmed. Okay, what would that do to you guys? You'd be a little shocked, right? But think about what else is going on. I mean, this is normal. This is now normal behavior for this guy. This has become the new normal. But the new normal has been disrupted. And it's not like he got better over time, because, you know, you can kind of see that, right? That you could handle. But it's like a night and day shift, right? And there's this guy that is obviously responsible for this, right? Obviously responsible for this. What is your opinion of this guy? Yeah, Elmore? Oh, yeah, we'll get to that in just a second, right? That's the second question, right? That's right after this, I promise. Right now, we're looking on the villagers, right? We'll look at this guy in just a second. But, I mean, how would you react if you were one of the people who lived in this town? I mean, yeah.
Well, first of all, this is a Gentile region.
Right.
So the things meant a lot to them. This is their livelihood.
And right. Right.
These are their livelihood. The Gentiles, they raise the stick for their livelihood.
Right. This is their local economy.
It's their Wall Street.
Yeah, it's their entire local economy, right? This is what it is.
So they wanted Christ to live. The fear, just the thing is, they have no, because of the superstitious thing that what Christ had done, they were not fearful. That they were fearful exactly, perhaps on one thing, that losing part of the business. That's why they on the account of Mark and Luke, they wanted to just go to leave right away.
Well, I mean, the desire for Jesus to leave is built on two things. Anger, right? Anger, because he destroyed their local economy. Which, you know, is what it is. And the other thing is that, you know, this is Gentile territory, but a lot of Jews still lived here, right? And so a lot of the people who are taking care of these pigs may very well actually have been Jews. Are Jews supposed to be keeping and holding pigs? No. which sort of throws another perspective on this as well. Right? There were still a lot of Jews on the northeastern shore of Galilee. And in some villages, they actually outnumbered Gentiles. So this was a problem for the local Jews, right? They're keeping and holding unclean animals, which they're not really supposed to do. And so Jesus has, in the span of just a couple of minutes, destroyed their local economy. Just gone, right? So there's anger. Now, a lot of times, if a guy did this, what would the village be tempted to do? A little bit of street justice, right? Take him out back, somewhere where nobody would find him. There's a lot of holes out in that desert. But the thing is, look what happened to this guy. Which means this man has some kind of power that the Gentiles don't understand, that the Jews probably do understand, and that makes them terrified. And the Gentiles asking the Jewish residents what's going on, and the Jewish residents filling the Gentiles in, right? Saying, if you try and hurt this man, this is what's going to happen. You're all going to die, right? And so that's why they tell Jesus to leave. That's why they ask him to leave. Because, I mean, it's a combination of both anger and fear together, right? They're so angry at him that a lot of them probably want to kill Jesus, but they're too scared to do it. So the only option that they have left is to ask him to leave. Because this guy just destroyed your entire village's livelihood. Do you want him staying there? What's he going to do next, right? And that's what they're afraid of. What's he going to do next? On the other hand, though, and so that's the people's response, right? On the other hand, this guy, as Elmore says, asked Jesus, take me with you. Let me come with you. Right? So what does Jesus tell this guy? No. Go back home. And do what? Yeah. So, by the way, what does that strike you guys as odd, what Jesus tells this guy? It does to me. This is different from his other interactions with people that he's healed. Did you guys sort of notice why? Or is it kind of not hitting you guys right now? Okay. You're nodding your head. Is that, yeah?
Well, the same thing happened with a Samaritan woman, and she was a Gentile.
Yeah, right? So that throws something. She was kind of like, well, she was a Gentile, but she didn't think she was a Gentile, right? But she was a Gentile. She was kind of half Gentile, half not. We don't really, it's kind of like there's, the Samaritans were other, right? Jew, Gentile, not really either, right? But she's not a Jew. Right, that's clear. The woman at the well in John 4, right? That's what Bob's referring to, which hasn't been a part of our study right now because this is just Matthew, Mark, and Luke, right? And this guy living in Gentile territory. We don't know whether this guy is a Jew or a Gentile. We have no idea. We don't know. He could be either, right? But what Jesus tells this guy and what he tells the Samaritan woman are the same, which is different from what he tells all the other people that he's healed in the scriptural narrative. All the other people that he heals, what does he tell them?
Tell no one.
Shh. Don't tell anybody. Right? But to the Samaritan woman and to this guy, he says, go tell everybody. Why?
He was prodigal.
There's something interesting about the character of these two individuals, right? The Samaritan woman and this man. That, you know, they have this interaction with Jesus, right? You know, all the other people, they come to Jesus for healing, and then after that, they're done with him. Did you guys ever sort of pick up on that in Scripture? all the other people, all the Jews who come to Jesus, come to him for healing, and then they're done with him. And on the case in which he heals most of the people, right? There's the man in John 9, which is another interesting case, right? Mary and Martha and Lazarus, right? The vast majority, I'll say that. The vast majority of people who come to Jesus for healing, come to him for healing and are done with him. Like, that's the vast majority of cases. The people who are different are few and far between. You've got Mary, Martha, you've got Lazarus, you've got the man who was born blind in John 9, you've got the Samaritan woman, you've got this guy, right? In the instance in which Jesus heals 10 lepers, 9 of them were Jews, 1 of them was a Samaritan. Only the Samaritan came back to Jesus to say, thank you. Right? The Jews got healed and they were done. That's most people that Jesus heals. Like, physically in the scriptural narrative. Right? It's the other people that should stand out to us. Because it's the other people that we should be. Right? We should be this guy. We should be the guy who was born blind in John. We should be the Samaritan woman. We should be those guys. Right? Because the thing that makes them different is their behavior after their healing. Right? So, what does their behavior after their healing show about them that other people's behavior shows that they don't have? Gratitude, right? Elmore. Right.
Why Christ is not allowed to go on the court? Perhaps in some ways, so he can proclaim to the Gentile region.
And that might be a part of it. Right. All right. And the Samaritans didn't know God as well as they thought they knew God. Right? They thought they knew him, but they didn't really know God the way they should have. And, you know, we've traced the evolution of the Samaritans when we studied the Old Testament, so we know why this is the case, right? And we understand their self-deception, right? And how it came about and why it happened, right? So they don't know God as well as they thought they did, and so this is an opportunity for Jesus to use this Samaritan woman and say, look, you tell them what God is really like. And so there's this opportunity for this, and that might be a part of it too, right? But when I look at all the others, you got the man who was born blind in Jerusalem in John 9, who's obviously Jewish, right? But he sort of gets the same instructions, right? Which there's a little bit of doubt on, you know, that I'm not saying that's not a part of it, but, you know, there's something to these individuals and the gratitude that they show, which means they valued Jesus as more than just a source of physical healing, right? Because after that, what did they do? I mean, they got healed, they said, thank you, and this guy is a perfect example. What is he doing with Jesus when the villagers find him? He's talking with Jesus, right? And he's listening to Jesus, right? He's asking him questions. He's getting answers, right? So for this guy, it's not just the healing. When Jesus heals him, he's not done. He's like, okay, now I can really get to why I want to talk to you, right? And the interactions that Jesus has with Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, they, especially Mary, right, has this attitude, right? Right. Right, and who's the more effective witness, right, than someone who really values what has been done for them, right? You think about which of the 12 went further and farther to spread the message of Jesus. I mean, who did more work? Or who does it seem like did more work? Not trying to diminish the work that all the other guys did, but who's always the one going places and starting churches and talking to people and just going out there and talking to like the last people you would expect a Jew to talk to? Paul, right? Because Paul, I mean, you know, you think about the other 12, and it's not that the other 12 aren't grateful for what Jesus has done for them, because they obviously are, right? And that comes across through their writing, right? You look at 1 Peter, he's definitely grateful for all that Christ has done for them. There's no question of that, right? And but Paul's response seems a little bit more visceral, you know? Maybe that's a faulty analysis. I have no idea, right? But just from the sheer volume of work that Paul did, we can see how, like I said, I'm not trying to diminish the gratitude of the others or the work that they have done. We just don't have as much written about them, right? And we don't have as many of their written works surviving. But we do have a lot about Paul. We do have a lot of things that he wrote that are left. And he's an easy example for us to point to and say, look at this guy, right? And look at how he behaved from, you know, the day that he met Jesus on the road to Damascus, from that day to the end of his life, right? Marcus. Yeah. 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 Well, the Samaritan woman at the well in John 4, right? The woman who is extremely promiscuous, right? And And that might be a part of it, right? That Jesus uses these three individuals, right, in this way. And Marcus is picking up on something actually really great, by the way. One of the other things all these three individuals have in common, right, this guy, right, the guy who's possessed by this legion, right, the woman at the well in John 4, and the man who was born blind in John 9, they have a remarkable ability to not care what people think of them because they care more about what Jesus thinks of them, right? And that is effective too. And that's something that's valuable in someone who's going to be a proclaimer of the word of Christ, is because, you know, there's, you're going to meet some opposition. Kennedy, and then Elmore, and then Bob. Kennedy? Right. Right. Right, and that's about, you know, observing the law, right? Making sure things are done properly according to the law. Elmore?
Well, when you talk about Paul, he calls himself this is the apostle. Yeah. It's a complete turnaround of his life being he consented for the death of
Christians, of God's people. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that's why sort of Paul seems to stand out to us a lot, is because he went from such an extreme, right? I mean, the other 12, they didn't kill Christians before they became the 12, right? Paul did, right? Which is like, that's sort of this difference, and why we tend to, as people, look at it that way. Of course, you know, the thing that we have to realize and sort of a, in an objective point of view, what James says is if you violate the law in one respect, you violate it in all respects, right? If you break one law, you're a lawbreaker, right? So, you know, that's sort of our human assessment of things at times, right? But, it, you know, it makes an impact on us as humans. Yeah, Bob?
The prodigal son and his brother have many parallels with the naked man and the established Jewish traditions.
Yeah, they do, right? And, you know, that comes out in the guy who's like, when we're looking at these similar themes, these echoing themes, right? You've got the guy possessed by the legion, right? The guy in the tombs, the naked man, and the guy who is born blind, right? And there's this really, it's not just sort of a parallel between, I mean, it's an actual confrontation between this guy and the Jewish establishment that happens, right? Yeah, and the parallel with the prodigal son, right? Yeah, and that is sort of a great echo with two of these three cases, right? So the guy who was born blind, sort of, you could look at him as sort of a more directly related parallel, right, to the prodigal son. Although, you know, one of the fascinating differences is that the guy who was born blind, Jesus says, you know, this guy isn't really guilty of massive sin, right? When that whole narrative starts, because, you know, when they're walking by the exit to the temple, right? His disciples say, who sinned, this guy or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus just does the Picard facepalm, you know, ugh, right? It's like, no, guys, this is not how it works, okay? Right? But I'm going to use this opportunity to show you what God's power is really like, right? Carol, did you have your hand up? No, okay. So there's a lot going on here, right? And ultimately, what Jesus tells him is, "Look, you got to tell people what God's done for you, right? Because this guy's useful as a witness, right? And Jesus doesn't waste opportunities." And he says, I'm going to use this guy the best way I can use him. I want you to go tell people what God's done for you. So, once Jesus is back in Jewish territory, right, who meets him and what's his position? A guy named Jairus, right? Which is actually probably, in Hebrew, this is probably the name Yair, right? Which the Germans would spell J-A-I-R. The Greeks just like to tack in and tack on an O-S or a U-S at the end of stuff, right? And Yair, this guy, probably named after one of the judges, right? Remember? Jair, Jephthah, that guy. The one who's got like a verse written about him. Unfortunately, that's it. So here we have Jairus, right? He's sort of the ruler of the synagogue. He's the town rabbi. That's what he is. He's the rabbi, right? And as the rabbi, he's familiar with the law and the prophets, right? So he comes to Jesus, this rabbi, and what? Why, right? What's happening with his family? His daughter's dying, right? His daughter is dying, and he doesn't know what to do. So he goes to Jesus as soon as Jesus sort of comes back in their territory, right? And you know, he says, I need your help. My daughter is dying, right? First of all, what does this reveal about Jairus, by the way? He believed that Jesus could do something about it, right? He said, I need your help. I know you can do this. Right? And my daughter's dying, we need you. He believed that Jesus could do something about it. Which means, what does he acknowledge about Jesus? That he has power. And what in turn does that mean he acknowledges about Jesus being a rabbi? That Jesus is more than just a wandering rabbi. Right? I won't quite go as far as Jule said and said that that Jairus thought he was the Son of God. Because we can't establish that from the text. But we can establish one thing. What did Nicodemus believe about Jesus? No, not yet. Not in John. Not until like after the crucifixion, right? That you're a teacher. You're a rabbi who's come from God. What does the scripture call rabbis who have been commissioned by God? Prophets. Nicodemus knew Jesus was a prophet, right? And the capital P Old Testament. Miracle-working, wrath-of-God-delivering prophet. And Jairus now apparently is acknowledging the same thing. Because as a rabbi, when he acknowledges this power that Jesus has, right, he's putting Jesus alongside Elijah and Elisha and Joseph and Moses, right? All of the great prophets of the Old Testament scripture. If Jairus is saying, you can do this, I need your help, he's lumping Jesus right in with all those other guys, which makes him an oddity. Well, maybe not for Galilee, because remember, most of Jesus' work at this point has been done in Galilee, which means that a lot of the towns in Galilee are not like Jerusalem. That Jesus gets quite a welcome in Capernaum, right? And as a matter of fact, the synagogue leaders in Capernaum come to Jesus and ask him to do things, right? Remember the centurion whose slave was sick and dying? It's the synagogue leaders that come to Jesus and say, please, would you do this for this guy? So you've got the religious leadership in Galilee is not like the religious leadership in Jerusalem. Which is, does that seem interesting to you guys, by the way? Because what's the center of the Jewish world? Jerusalem, right? Who's supposed to be the religious leader of the Jews? As far as from an earthly perspective is concerned.
The high priest.
Thanks, Bob. The scribes and Pharisees ended up becoming that, but it should have been the high priest, right? But by this point, the scribes and the Pharisees and the high priest began to sort of work together a lot, right? That the Pharisees had sort of just acquired an established place within the religious society of Jews, so that they sort of acted as a non-liturgical arm of the priesthood, right? That the priests often used the Pharisees to teach, right? And some of the priests, by the way, ended up becoming Pharisees. There were a lot of priests who were also Pharisees, right? And some of the priests wore two hats. Yeah.
Caiaphas was the high priest, and there was another son-in-law that was a high priest. So he would.
Caiaphas was the son-in-law. Annas was the father-in-law. Yeah.
You're supposed to inherit it through being a son, not being a son-in-law, and you can't have two high priests at the same time.
Yeah, and we'll get to that when we do the whole crucifixion narrative, right?
All
yeah.
Corrupt and backwards and overwritten.
It was. Right? It was. I mean, the religious establishment in Jerusalem had a lot of corruption going on. You know, economic, societal, political.
Roman,
right? Which was, you know, economic and political, right? There was a lot of corruption going on. You know, but when you get farther out away from the center, away from Jerusalem, you've got these rabbis out in Galilee who are calling Jesus a prophet and, like, asking him to come do things and teach. Right? Giving him invitations to come and talk because they believe he's a prophet, which is sort of like, do you guys find it ironic at all that the Jews who really accept Jesus as a prophet are the ones who are not in Jerusalem? Because who knew the law best, technically? Technically, who knew what the text said better? The Pharisees and the scribes, right? I mean, it was the Pharisees, that was the scribes, their living was just writing it all day long, right? So they ended up becoming scholars of the law anyway, just through the process of their profession, right? But the Pharisees specifically devoted themselves to that task. Like, we talked about training to be a Pharisee meant from the time you were 5 to the time you were 13, you were working on memorizing all 39 books of what we call the Old Testament. And by the time you were 13, you were supposed to have all of them memorized. And if you didn't, well, then you failed. And you were out and you were done for the rest of your life. You could never be a Pharisee. Deuteronomy 17. The Israelite kings were supposed to write for themselves a copy of the law, at least the Pentateuch, right? The first 5 books of Scripture of the Old Testament, and keep it with them all the days of their life and read from it every single day. Those instructions are found in Deuteronomy chapter 17, right? So, you know, these people knew what it said, but which ones were the ones really living out what it meant? Well, the Galilean rabbis seemed to be doing a better job of it, right?
The common people, or the ones far away from the bureaucracy.
The ones farther away from the center of where power was located. I mean, when you compare the Jerusalem rabbis versus the Galilean rabbis definitely seem to be doing a better job of acknowledging what Scripture really means in a lot of instances than the Jerusalem rabbis. and how they treat Jesus is sort of a manifestation of that, right? And Jairus seems cut from the same cloth as the rabbis in Capernaum, for example. I think that's sort of an interesting thing that comes out in the gospel narrative, right? So, you know, here we are with this all happening. While they're on the way, what happens to Jesus? By the way, this is sort of the question that we're going to close with, right? And we're gonna finish up after this question is answered. That's going to be the close of our class. So we'll pick up next week, sort of continuing the thread of this narrative. So first of all, what happens when he's going there? Well, first of all, a lot of people touch him, right? Because there's crowds pressing in on him from every angle. But one woman goes up and touches him like in a way that's different from everybody else. Because what he says is, "Who touched me?" Right? And his disciples are like, "Man, what you talking about? Everybody's touching you." And Jesus is like, No. You don't understand. I felt my power work in somebody. That means someone touched me and it was different from everybody else. So who touched me? Right? And so we're going to look at why that touch was different next week. We're going to pick up with that, right? So thank you, everybody, for being here for our Bible class. We're going to have about a 15-minute break, and then we'll have our worship service for the morning. And men of the congregation, please remember to meet in the back room to make Brother Cooper's job easier to sort out the assignments for our worship service this morning for the people who are missing.